Something's happening. We've known it for a long time.
The West knew it?
Here's your serious problem. America is addicted to oil.
It's inconceivable to me that our children will be able to maintain the American way of life and that the world won't be full of resource-based wars of all kinds.
The East knew it.
Successfully completed, it will provide for a significant increase in the volume of oil supplies from Russia to China.
We've known it for a century.
There is no doubt about our absolute and complete dependence on oil. Without oil, civilization as we know it could not exist.
Oil was running out. It's what we grew up in. Post-Middle East, post-peak oil, post-everything. What they called the long emergency. It started slow. Little things at first. Lines at the pump. That hot summer of 2008, when the blackouts started lasting weeks. The avian influenza hit in 09. I got taken out of school when there wasn't enough vaccine. They said it would get better. Something would save us. Biofuels, solar power, cleaner nuke plants, maybe. The Depression hit in 2012. Africa ran out of food, then we did too. People stopped trying to do anything about the problems and just tried to survive. We'd watched them starve for 40 years and it didn't seem real. But pretty soon the scenes we used to watch on the news were happening just down the street. It's been happening for years. Now we're at the tipping point.
Our opening clip comes not from a documentary of our times, but from a trailer for a new video game called Frontlines: Fuel of War. I suppose gamers really know the game is up, but even our collapse can be made into a profitable fantasy for the screen. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. You know, life has always been a battle between routine and interruptions. I say we are entering the age of interruptions. Privileged consumers hope the shopping carts will fill up forever. Commuting to work, shopping for fun, planning vacations far away, it's been fun living fat. We like it. We wanted to go on living as model consumers, the hope of the world. We'll do almost anything to keep this mobile parade of bursting store shelves and stuffed closets. Okay, we'll do anything. The big interruption appears to be the loud, cracking sound as capitalism buckles under its own weight. Now that the Wall Street Christmas bonus billions have been given away by bankrupt firms, the media is allowed to discuss, well, a slight readjustment.
The economic team reports that our economy has a solid foundation, but that there are areas of real concern.
He believes we're not only already in a recession, but that we're also headed towards a hyperinflationary depression. A kind of a technical term, if I may translate it to dummies like me, that's when $100 bills are used for toilet paper, I believe.
Now the patient is dying. And it's time for a radical operation, not some silly stimulus plan that costs $150 billion that sends just enough your way to pay for a nice suit.
Authors like Dmitry Orlov and James Howard Gunstler suggest the United States is falling, like its counterweight, the former Soviet Union. It just took a little longer. You've heard that America's largest bank, Citigroup, is being rescued by Muslim state governments, that the largest brokerage, Merrill Lynch, declared a $16 billion loss, the largest mortgage lender countrywide was saved by a fire sale buyout by the Bank of America. You probably didn't hear that the fraudsters who sold all those fantasy investments took off with $65 billion in bonus money last year alone from many of the same companies bleeding multi-billion dollar losses. Once the enormity of the situation is realized, and I think that will be soon, there will be endless lawsuits and government investigations. In fact, the city of Cleveland is already suing several banks, including Wells Fargo. The city alleges these lenders were predators on the poorest people, leading to mass foreclosures. Wrecked, abandoned homes have scarred the city. Over 1,000 perfectly good homes have been torn down after they were wrecked by the angry former homeowners and or vandalized by the numberless urban poor. Millions of homeless in the country, but we have to tear down houses. It is pitiless madness. This has led to a new phenomenon in the United States, another measurement of the pain. Some cities are being designated as refugee cities. That is where people are fleeing the breakdown of municipal services and city life. We have all imagined climate refugees and people fleeing from the wars. We never imagined that some major American cities would break down, as they are breaking down. Here's an excerpt from a speech by Canadian City Councillor Clive Doucette, where he describes refugee cities.
In the family values consumer vision of society, there are fair trade products for the richer, child labor products for the poorer, organic food for the richer, pesticide-fed food for the poorer, charter schools for the richer, public schools for the poorer, home child care for the richer, make-do care for the poorer, private health care for the richer, welfare, public care for the poor, and so on, until the city, the nation, and the planet are divided up into a first tier and a second tier services, until citizens no longer live in nations where basic rights and services that apply to all have been abandoned in favor of public-private supply store. Let's call it GovMart, where each citizen is free to choose his mix of public-private products based on their ability to pay user charges. This is a recipe for creating unsustainable cities. This is New Orleans, absolutely. This is Buffalo, this is Detroit, this is Cleveland. This is the recipe for refugee cities. Because at the end of the day, cities have to work for all their residents, not just some of them. Nations are so large they can get along for a very long time with substantial territories that suffer terribly from poverty, suicide, despair. But cities have much smaller tolerances, simply because everyone lives so much closer to each other. Thus, the rot spreads much faster. The good news is, if you can get it right, the productive and successful also spread much faster. Look around the city at cities, and you can see the human equivalent of shrinking ice surfaces. Urban habitats are more populous and popular than ever, but they're becoming ever more fragile. Believe you me, the Vancouvers of the world are the exceptions. You're living in quite a delightful and exceptional place. Cities that used to be secure destinations for refugees from economic and civil conflicts are becoming themselves sources of refugees. What used to be the exception, a city that no longer can support its population, that generates refugees rather than offers refuge, is becoming more common. The most dramatic North American example is New Orleans, but there are many others. Refugee cities all share the same basic characteristics. Entire neighborhoods become vandalized shells. Public infrastructure is battered, broken, and unreliable. This means schools, libraries, train stations, parks, public places are not places you would want to frequent unless you had no other choice. In refugee cities, both petty and violent crime become a way of life. In cities like Detroit, Cleveland, Buffalo, Mogadishu, Nairobi, Murmansk, you're seeing this sort of phenomena. The predictions are over the next 50 years, the Russian population will diminish from 150 million to 90. And it's also clear climate change-driven disasters lurk around the corners for Sunbelt cities like Atlanta and Phoenix, where water supplies are down to, I think in Atlanta, it's 90 days. The lake they're drawing water from is disappearing. In Detroit, the population declines by about 1,000 people every month. And like any other refugee city, it is in the anomalous position of not having enough city services and too many. It has more neighborhoods, roads, and public services than it needs, and the ones that continue to be occupied don't have enough services. Fortunately, Canada doesn't have any refugee cities. Canada is in the happy position of being populated by refuge cities, cities that people are fleeing towards and in many cases dying to get to. A refuge city is the inverse of a refugee city. It is a place where people want to move to. In the United States, cities like Seattle, New York, Portland, Boulder, Colorado. In refuge cities, municipal services remain intact, efficient, and universal. Schools are repaired, safe, pleasant, and well-staffed. Sidewalks are repaired and walkable. Concert halls, theaters, and streets are well-patronized at any time of the day or night. In a refuge city, public transit is something you complain about but aren't afraid to use. Green parks are green and popular, not desolate and dirty. Neighborhoods are self-organized and run by confident, cranky residents who think they run the city, not the jackass who got elected. The refuge city employment base is diverse and resistant to the global bullying of give me a tax break or we'll leave town. In refuge cities, police rely on news of crime in other cities to keep their budgets from being reduced. Quebec City, for example, had one murder in 2006. Crime in the city of Ottawa has steadily declined year over year, and what murders there are sad products of domestic chagrin or the mentally ill.
I recorded that for Radio EcoShock, and I'll be making the whole speech available soon. The flip side is some cities are still functioning. These Doucette calls refuge cities, the places where people go for a hope of jobs, medical systems that work, schools that are safe. Meanwhile, the process of capitalism is a transfer of wealth from the many to the few. Nowhere do we see this more clearly than in the subprime mortgage scam. Lenders went aggressively to the poorest people, the people of color. The African American community was hit particularly hard. Whatever people of color had managed to save through working two or three jobs was taken into the banks with a promise of the American dream, a house of your own, a real bedroom for your kids. Now you can have it, but you can't keep it. Here is a digest of the radio program Building Bridges, a report on how subprime mortgages were aimed at the poorest communities. The program was broadcast on New York Public Radio, WBAI, on January 14, 2007. At the end of the full program, there is a phenomenal speech by Martin Luther King in 1965. I have only included a few bits from the original half-hour show.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on, Building Bridges will celebrate the life of Martin Luther King Jr. with a rare speech by the Reverend King to District 65 UAW in October 1963.
But first, the new report by United for a Fair Economy on what has caused the greatest loss of wealth to people of color in modern U.S. history, the subprime lending crisis.
For tens of millions of people in the U.S., owning a home is the essence of the American dream, representing as it does economic achievement and some measure of security. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would have undoubtedly agreed and aspired to make the dream more broadly available to blacks, Latinos, and Asians, as well as whites, to poor people, as well as rich.
But now the subprime lending crisis has spread its tentacles across the country, causing the greatest wealth setback for people of color ever. We're joined by Brenda Cotto Escalera, Executive Director of United for a Fair Economy, and Ahmad Rivera, Director of United for a Fair Economy's Racial Wealth Divide Program, and we welcome both of you. I'm absolutely staggered by the depth and the pain that radiates out from this report that the subprime lending crisis has caused the greatest wealth setback for people of color in modern history.
I think that's a great, great thing to really bring aware that we've spent a long time trying to use public policy to help create equality by building assets for people of color. And usually that cornerstone of the American dream is built on home ownership. And while we've had some problems in the past and with home ownership and race, there were some great view that this is really going to help and really expand homeownership. And what's happened is that these predatory practices using racial bias have stripped away all of that home ownership. So all these homes that were built, these homes that were refinanced, these first-time home buyers, all of that wealth that they had built up, that may have been the first time in generations that they had homes, is being taken away from them by the predatory practices of mortgage brokers and institutions that back these mortgage brokers.
United for a Fair Economy, it's really important to note that this loss of individual wealth then has a consequence of loss of community wealth, because people owning their homes brought a lot of wealth and a lot of benefits to the community, from better schools to community centers to work together. And we are seeing boarded up homes, increase in crime, less money in the tax base for school finance. So it is a spillover effect that, because it has concentrated so much on people of color, it has also concentrated in communities of color.
Ahmad, has the crisis affected people of color in greater proportion than the numbers in the population? And if so, why?
Well, one of the great things about what we're releasing, the State of the Dream Foreclosed, is that blacks and Latinos are 2 to 3 times more likely than their white counterparts to receive any of these loans, and that they have been done, that is twice or three times their representation in the population. And when you actually look at the foreclosure rates, those numbers are also higher in those communities. And so one of the reasons why that typically happens is, when we're looking at economic inequality, the most disenfranchised, the people who oftentimes can be the most vulnerable, when there are no regulations, such as in the subprime lending market, they were let to roam free and prey on these people, that those people are typically the ones who have to deal with this brunt of these issues. What's interesting is that, because they were preyed upon, we are now seeing spillover effect not only in the communities, but in the United States whole economy, which is even now starting to affect some of the worldwide economy, all because these unregulated mortgage brokers really were allowed to roam free and take advantage of the most vulnerable in our country.
In terms of getting a mortgage that is not subprime, has discrimination entered into the picture that blacks and other people of color haven't been able to get non-subprime mortgages and therefore have to get these subprime mortgages?
There's incredible evidence that race has been the biggest factor, the biggest predictor on who gets a subprime mortgage loan and who doesn't. So in cases we've seen that, given the same income, the same credit history, that someone that was white would get a conventional loan and someone that was black or Latino would get a subprime. And right now there's a couple of cities that are suing because of this racial bias that happened, and that has been documented.
As a matter of fact, one of the cities is Cleveland, who is suing 21 lenders over subprime mortgages, and one of the issues is based on violation of the fair housing laws.
Mm-hmm. Ahmad, when we're saying a lot of people, how many people are we talking about nationwide here?
Overall, there's going to be about 2.2 million foreclosures. About a third of that are a third or more is about people of color. So we're looking at a good amount of people. We're really looking at a large percent of people, and that's just this year. So that 2.2 number are foreclosures happening this year.
It is normalcy in the nation that so often takes necessities from the masses to give luxuries to the classes. It is normalcy in the world that makes for the madness of militarism, the self-defeating effect of physical violence, and the poisoning of the atmosphere with nuclear tests. No, we will not return to that kind of normalcy. Never will we return to it.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nair.
You can find Building Bridges, a labor-oriented radio program, at wbai.org. The report on subprime and people of color is available from the organization United for a Fair Economy. Find them at faireconomy.org. The report is called Foreclosed: The State of the Dream. But the subprime scam, as we know, was just the water melting down deep, moving the whole financial glacier toward the sea. All the half-baked mortgages and loans to people counting on ever-increasing real estate values in their homes were rebundled as collateralized debt obligation CDOs and other strange derivatives. The original mortgage values, already overinflated, were multiplied several times to many investors, as capitalist banks do. That mountain of multiplied debt was then sold off all over the world. Big German and Korean banks bought them. Pension funds bought them. Small municipalities from Wisconsin to the Australian outback bought these securities. After all, the ratings companies said these investments were AAA. Well, now the companies and banks which issued them, like Merrill Lynch and Citigroup, are writing off their own CDOs as worthless. Worse, banks and all sorts of institutions bought insurance for their investments in case there was a loss. The insurance companies have no hope of paying off all that bad debt. The insurance companies themselves will go bust or be bailed out by governments. You, the taxpayer, and your children will go into big debt just to pay off the scandals of Wall Street, just like the savings and loan government bailout, which still hasn't been paid off. All this turmoil leads many of us to wonder whether capitalism can survive. A simple history of capitalism shows the close links to piracy. Now the pirates have left, with their billions for their offshore havens. The industrial system of America has been gutted, shipped overseas. Confidence in the dollar and government bonds is shattered. And you know, when George Bush steps in to help, the disaster is already out of control. Bush reminds me of the character George Costanza in the Seinfeld comedy TV show. George discovers that every instinct he has is wrong. He should do the opposite. History will show that George Bush and his administration have gone wrong on almost every important issue. They stalled action on climate change in America and internationally during the key period when action might have saved terrible changes. We know his record on Katrina and, of course, the war in Iraq. And now he wants to hand out $800 to everybody to go shopping? That should fix the missing trillions, and yes, I said trillions, of dollars in the phony money pumped up in the world of finance. But all of this is the human circus on a blue planet in deep trouble. Many Greens deeply doubt that capitalism can meet any of the challenges it creates. All the light bulb changing, the phony trades in carbon that let the smokestacks keep belching, the failed climate talks. Can there be a green capitalism? Or will we see abrupt social change in reaction to abrupt changes in the financial markets, in the oil supply, and the ever more inhospitable climate? I don't pretend to know the answers. I am not now, nor have I ever been a communist. Still, here are two speakers who claim green capitalism is impossible. That sort of social action, socialism, must develop into a new economic and political model for the long emergency. First up, George Monbiot, columnist for The Guardian newspaper in Britain and author of the book Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning. Monbiot spoke at the climate rally in Britain on December 8, 2007. You can hear the whole speech on YouTube. Monbiot is spelled M-O-N-B-I-O-T, and you can find him at monbiot.com. But I want to play just a clip with the clearest description I've ever heard of capitalism and why it must grind down the planet to nothing just to continue growing.
Let me just explain why we are currently committed to economic growth. And let me mention something which is very seldom mentioned on political platforms these days for fear of offending people profoundly, and this is the C word, capitalism. Let me try to explain this in very simple terms, because it is in fact a very simple problem. At the heart of capitalism is the practice of lending money at interest. You lend £100, you expect to get £105 back. That's what capitalism is all about. It's about using money to make more money. But if you get £105 back, you have done one of two things. The first is to increase the money supply by 5%. The second is to increase the velocity of transactions, in other words, the speed at which people spend, by 5%. One of those two things is necessary if you're increasing your payback from £100 to £105. Now, unless that growth in the money supply or the velocity of the use of money is matched by a concomitant growth in the supply of goods and services, then that 5% that you've just added to your intake of money becomes 5% inflation. The only way in which that growth in the money supply is not inflationary is if it is matched by a concomitant growth in the supply of goods and services. If that is not the case, the system collapses. This is why the Bank of England is established, to prevent inflation, and it prevents inflation by encouraging the supply of goods and services to match the supply of money. Capitalism, in other words, is inherently dedicated to a growth economy. You cannot, ladies and gentlemen, have green capitalism. It is a contradiction in terms. And you don't even have to take a political position to say that. You don't have to say that you're a socialist or a communist. You just have to understand that mathematically it cannot work. Our challenge is not just to change our light bulbs and drive better cars or even ride our bicycles. It's not just to decarbonize our energy supply by 100%. It is to change our entire economic thinking and our entire economic system.
Very profound from George Monbiot there at the Climate Campaign, December 2007. In capitalism, we must mine more, cut more, pollute more, filling the world with plastic trinkets and machinery to justify the increase in the money supply that is assumed by compound interest. Capitalism must always grow or collapse. We have grown to peak everything. We are hauling out the last beasts of the forest for food and decoration, cutting down rainforests to grow biofuel for SUVs, grabbing the last edible creatures of the sea. We have grown to 6 or 7 billion people and still going, all wanting cars, monster homes, and more fatty foods. When we reach the limit, we begin the process of collapse, whether slowly over decades or very quickly indeed. I've just recorded another speech by the eco-socialist Ian Angus. The event was called Can We Stop Climate Change?, held in Vancouver, January 20th, 2008. Ian Angus sums up our situation after the failure of the Bali climate talks in December.
We have Ian Angus in town. Ian Angus is the editor of the online journal Climate and Capitalism. Ian Angus is also the founder and coordinating committee member of the Eco-Socialist International Network. Ian Angus was actually in town this weekend as a keynote speaker at a conference that took place dealing with the issue of climate change. It was a conference at UBC called Smells Like Green Spirit, which took place yesterday and the day before. With that, I'd like everybody to please welcome Ian Angus.
Thanks, Mike. And thank you all for coming out on a Sunday afternoon. I've been in Vancouver for 5 days on this trip, and this is the first day of sunshine, so look where I am. Back in September, as part of the preparations for the Bali conference, the United Nations held a one-day meeting in New York to discuss climate change, and they invited all of the heads of state they could arrange to come and senior officials of countries. Most of the speeches were predictably bland and predictably meaningless. Everybody made promises and assertions, and nobody actually said very much. Most, but not all of them. One really noteworthy exception was Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, the first indigenous head of state in the Western Hemisphere since the European conquest. His written statement and speech were remarkably powerful denunciations of capitalism, colonialism, as the cause of global warming. In fact, his opening sentence, you imagine all these guys have been getting up and giving these sort of very abstract speeches, and he starts off with, "The world is suffering from a fever due to climate change, and the disease is the capitalist development model." And he went on from there. That was the starting point of his talk. His entire submission and his speech really deserve to be read. I just have not seen anything so remarkable from a senior politician or head of state in a very, very long time. Just for now, I want to focus on one sentence in his presentation, which I thought was very sharp. He said, "We need to create a World Environment Organization which is binding and which can discipline the World Trade Organization, which is propelling us towards barbarism." Now, you could read that sentence as a call for another United Nations bureaucracy. There are many of them. They hold conferences. They meet all over the world. And they issue meaningless declarations. Or perhaps you could interpret it as a call for some new kind of non-governmental organization, some new NGO. But that isn't what Ivo meant. Let me just quote another little piece of his talk to give you an idea of what he means when he says we need a World Environmental Organization that can discipline the WTO. He says, "I feel it is important to organize an international movement to deal with the environment, a movement that will be above institutions, businesses, and countries that only talk about commerce, that only think about accumulating capital. We have to organize a movement that will defend life, defend humanity, and save the earth." In that first sentence I quoted, he said that climate justice has to be paramount, that saving the environment must take absolute precedence over capitalism, a World Environment Organization, he calls it, with tongue a little bit in cheek, I suspect, that would have the power and the mandate to stop the WTO and similar neoliberal institutions. And in the second passage, he makes it very clear that what he's talking about is not a bureaucratic institution, but an international grassroots movement that will defend life, defend humanity, and save the earth. That's a remarkably important concept, and not the kind of thing you normally hear from a head of state. I tried to say somewhat the same thing, although I got to say I wasn't anywhere near as eloquent as Evo Morales in the article after Bali that I wrote for the latest issue of Socialist Voice. You can get the article on the table outside. The Bali conference last December in Indonesia was a concrete demonstration of the need for the kind of movement that Evo Morales called for, a clear demonstration of the utter bankruptcy of the kind of politics that has dominated the discussion of climate change for more than two decades. Nearly 12,000 people went to Bali last month. I don't know if they all bought carbon offsets. There were heads of state, senior bureaucrats, scientists, NGOs of all kinds assembled in a tropical paradise, filling up the vacation hotels and the conference halls. For 2 weeks, the largest gathering on climate change ever held on the face of the earth discussed and debated what to do about the fact that if we continue with business as usual, we will face catastrophic climate change worldwide. So what was the result? 12,000 people, 2 weeks in Bali. Who knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars spent to make it happen? Well, there's an old Greek fable that refers to the mountain labored and brought forth a mouse. And that's what we got out of Bali. The Bali Action Plan is the official outcome. You can read it as many times as you want. You will find no commitment to action anywhere in the Bali Action Plan. Sunita Narain, who's the director of the Center for Science and Environment in New Delhi, described it as the mother of all no deals. She said, "Let's cut through the histrionics of the Bali conference to understand that as far as an agreement is concerned, the world has not moved one inch from where it stood 17 years ago when negotiations started." She said, "The only difference is that the emissions have increased and climate change is now at dangerous levels." And then she goes on to describe the Bali Action Plan. First, no targets have been set for developed nations to cut emissions. No time frame has been set for when emissions would have to peak and then fall. Second, it accepts that the countries will take on actions but not commitments. Countries will have voluntary targets, which can be quantified or they can be in the form of targets. This negates, if not destroys, the previous global consensus that the developed, rich, and high carbon debt world should take on emission reduction commitments, the targets must be agreed on through multilateral processes, and these must be legally binding and enforceable. In effect, she says, what you've got here is a lot of nice words and no content, nothing whatsoever. Now, let me be a little fair here. There were some concrete decisions made in Bali. Actually, there was one. It takes one of Kyoto's very worst features, the Clean Development Mechanism, and it makes it worse. That's what they did in Bali. The Clean Development Mechanism is a component of the Kyoto Protocol that says that major polluters in industrialized countries can avoid reducing their own emissions by investing in clean projects in the third world. Often this means cutting down trees and then planting palm trees, just to prove now we planted trees, we get some credit for that. Morally, this is a completely bizarre concept. George Monbiot has, I think, rightly compared it to the idea that in the Middle Ages, when sinners could pay the church in order to be forgiven, you sort of got a get-out-of-hell-free card. That's what the CDM is about. It's even worse because it's very often corrupt, and it's almost impossible to measure the result of a Clean Development Mechanism project. So the result is there's enormous amounts of cash flowing around with absolutely no results to show for it. What did the Bali delegates do about the Clean Development Mechanism, which, by the way, has been thoroughly condemned by anybody who studied it? The CDM is an outrage, a method of offloading the problems that were caused in the global north onto the global south, at the best of cases, and in many cases, a method of doing nothing and making a lot of cash for it. Well, they noticed that they couldn't do everything they wanted under CDM because deforestation was not included in the original Kyoto Protocol. So they put it in. So now you can get paid for not cutting down trees. The impact of this plan is going to be particularly harsh on indigenous and poor peoples in the global south, because this has already happened under the existing CDM in other areas. What you see then is enclosure and privatization of the forests, overriding the rights of the people who live there, so that governments and or corporations can then claim credit for not cutting the trees down, because they're now private, and they said they were going to cut them down, but we changed our mind, pay us now. Credits that represent trees, as I say, they promise not to cut down. It's just one more example of the practices that were condemned by third world activists in 2004 at the meeting of the Durban that launched the Durban Declaration, which said that CDM projects appropriate land, water, and air already supporting the lives and livelihoods of local communities for new carbon dumps for northern industries. And that's precisely what this is about. And the only significant and concrete thing that came out of Bali was a decision to make it worse, a decision to expend it to other areas. Now, nobody who's familiar with the Harper government's record is going to be very surprised that Canada played a particularly appalling role in the Bali talks. One thing, it was hard to get from the press, but there were actually two conferences going on at once in Bali. One was the meeting of the parties to the Kyoto Accord, i.e. everybody but the United States, and the other one was the meeting of everybody. So in the meeting the United States couldn't be in, Canada took the role of stopping any action from getting into development. In the other meeting, the Americans did it themselves, but they let us do it, or at least our government do it. It got completely absurd. You probably read all the accounts in the paper of this dramatic thing that happened where the U.S. had fought right to the bottom line at the very last day. In fact, they were in overtime. And then they suddenly got up and they dramatically said, well, we're joining in. We're withdrawing our objections so that we can have unanimous vote. Canada did it, too. It was like Baird had to do it. If Bush did it, Baird had to do it, or Bush's representatives. But by the time they did do this, they had already totally gutted the agreement. The original, they had stopped anything from happening. Now, the U.S.-Canada position was counterposed, I must say, to a position that wasn't an awful lot better. The European Union, which is generally less dependent on coal and oil than North America is, initially proposed to mention, now let me stress that, mention, not decide on, but mention possible emission targets that would be at the low end of what was recommended by scientists. But when U.S., Canada, and Japan objected to even mentioning the idea that you would have targets, the European Union capitulated, and they replaced all mentions of targets with a footnote to a couple of pages in the middle of a 700-page document, which, by the way, doesn't have targets on it. But it's the only place there's any numbers in all of this, is in the footnote. So actually, I should correct that. There are no numbers in the footnote. There's numbers in the place the footnote goes to. So we end up with a report that does nothing. Now, the whole purpose of the Bali meeting was to set a framework for negotiating for a treaty that would replace Kyoto. Kyoto expires in 2012. So the goal here was to start figuring out what was going to happen to get to a replacement for Kyoto. Based on what happened in Bali, we can expect the next treaty to be worse than Kyoto. It's already an agreement that was phenomenally weak, had very low targets, and included things like clean development mechanism, carbon trading, and other things. We can expect that the sections on reducing emissions in the next agreement from the rich countries will be much weaker, and that the sections on offloading the problem onto the poorest countries and the poorest peoples will be much more harmful. If there's one thing that is obvious from Bali, it's obvious, in fact, it's painfully obvious, that we need a new kind of climate politics. We can't depend on business leaders and politicians and bureaucrats. They simply don't want to do it. And they don't want to do it because they're the owners and guardians of a system that has waste and ecological destruction built into its DNA. Its very nature is destructive and wasteful. They will not act, even if it means their own destruction, for crying out loud. To confront them effectively, the green movement, the green left movement, the eco-socialist movement, all of the currents, people who believe that something needs to be done, need to advance their own program. I've suggested in my article we call it a People's Agenda for Climate Change, but we could come up with a better name than that, I'm sure. A program that stresses reducing emissions in Canada and advancing climate change around the world and climate justice. The specific details of what we would have in such an agenda need to be worked out collaboratively by a wide range of activists. But these are some of the things that I would suggest we would include. First of all, unilateral adoption of the IPCC's recommendations for emissions targets. That is, none of this, we'll do it if everybody else does it. Canada has one of the worst records in the industrial world. We have a responsibility, no matter how you look at it, to start first. Secondly, on emissions trading plans and carbon tax schemes and all the other things that get floated around as gimmicks to avoid actually doing things, those are actually, in practice, highly regressive taxes that fall mainly on poor people. Canada should pose hard emissions on the emissions that are produced by the largest resource and energy companies, with heavy penalties for failure to comply. We should end all subsidies and tax breaks for the fossil fuel industry. We should immediately stop all expansion of operations in the tar sands and then rapidly close down existing operations. This moratorium thing that comes along, this is sort of like, well, would you not kill people quite so quickly, please? It has been described with considerable accuracy as the environmental crime of the century, and we should just say stop it. We should redirect military spending and the federal budget surplus into public energy-saving projects, such as expanding mass transit, retrofitting homes and office buildings. Tar sand workers and redeployed soldiers might play key roles in those projects. We should certainly look at that. And a people's agenda on climate change wouldn't stop just on the subject of reducing emissions in Canada. Because the discussion has to be not just about how do you reduce emissions, but winning climate justice globally. Recognizing that global warming has been created in the north, but its worst impact has been on the poorest people in the north and the south. We have an ecological debt of enormous proportions that we need to recognize. We have a moral responsibility to help clean up the destruction that's been caused by Canadian corporations abroad and to assist the developing world to shift to clean technology and to adapt to the change that we have made unavoidable. A substantial amount of global warming is going to come about even if we entirely stopped emissions tomorrow. And we have a responsibility to deal with that. These are just some of the things that a government that actually cared would do. Some of the things the Bali Conference might have done. But they didn't. And if we let them continue with climate politics as usual, they won't. Since they won't act, it's up to us. It's up to us to stop letting them speak for us. We have to stop begging, stop hoping that rational discussion will change their hearts and minds, stop relying on backroom lobbying, and we have to start demanding change. Meetings like this one, and the conference I was at this weekend, are part of building a movement. It will also include marches and rallies and sit-ins and occupations and guerrilla theater and all kinds of other things, all aiming at winning mass public support and mobilizing public opposition to the policy of doing nothing. Since they don't want to act, it's up to us to organize to ensure that they have no choice. Let me repeat what Evo Morales said last September. It is important to organize an international movement to deal with the environment, a movement that will be above institutions, businesses, and countries that just talk about commerce, that only think about accumulating capital. We have to organize a movement that will defend life, defend humanity, and save the Earth. In short, it's time to stop the climate vandals, because our planet is much more important than their profits. Thank you.
You've just heard Ian Angus with the Green Eco-Socialist View on climate change. Find Ian Angus at his blog, climateandcapitalism.com. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock, and we're deep into the subject of climate and capitalism. I began the show with the hot topic of the day, the unraveling economy. It is exciting to live during big changes, even bad ones. When we come out of the haze of sports talk and celebrity gossip, we gaze at crumbling institutions. Most people duck back inside the mass media cocoon, while the political debate becomes ever more irrelevant. Expect miles of ink and, whole big screens full of things and billions of hours of social attention to focus on the American economy and worldwide waves of worry. We can all pretend we're adults to learn what the word derivative really means, scam. This is where our municipal and pension funds go, but remember, life is interruption. While humans spin their attention, the giant interruption is growing unseen in the sky, moves in ocean currents, cracks open miles down under the ice. We call it climate change. Whatever happens to the war in Iraq, the collapse of the economy, and all those important things, we somehow have to keep focus, to focus the nation, because as we hear now from Evan Goldstein, we have just 3 years, until 2012, to create massive social change, to warp away from the carbon economy. The alternative is a planet of struggle, the hardest of times, for ourselves and all our descendants. At least in this interview, taken from the program Between the Lines, we find a growing awareness of the climate deadline, and it's being stimulated in the schools.
Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Evan Goodstein, founder and director of Focus the Nation and a professor of economics at Lewis and Clark College in Oregon. He explains how this effort differs from the groundbreaking grassroots actions of 2007 to raise awareness of global warming and what's at stake for today's youth who will be directly confronted by the climate change crisis.
We're all coordinating very closely, trying to build a movement, really, a social movement that moves America beyond where we are right now, which is, I think, a broad recognition of the impact of global warming and the fact that it's big and real and scary. But it's combined with a fatalism, a sense that we really can't do anything about it and that we're sort of forced to condemn our children to an impoverished planet. We're really trying to move America beyond that to sort of wake up and engage with this civilizational challenge.
I know there's overlap between your work and that of Bill McKibben's Step It Up effort and the student-run Power Shift conference that happened last November, but how is Focus the Nation different?
What's different about Focus the Nation is that we are institutionally based. Step It Up really was mobilizing kind of ad hoc committees of community activists and others. And what we're really doing is creating a sort of a deep educational engagement at educational institutions primarily across the country. So every major four-year college in the country, hundreds of community colleges, hundreds of high schools are really engaging in a serious kind of conversation about global warming solutions.
I went to your website and saw your proposed curriculum, which is unbelievably extensive.
The key, how do you actually mobilize, 1,000 students or more? Because the problem of global warming education is, if you show a movie or have a lecture, you get the usual 100 or 150 students to show up. So we were faced with this challenge of how do we get thousands of students on every campus engaged. And the key here is to get faculty engaged. So what we've done on our website is we've designed, proposed agenda for the day that includes 45 sessions, slots for 110 faculty members. We have a session on obstacles to change. So you might hear at Lewis and Clark, for example, we're going to have a psychology professor talking for 10 minutes about denial, a communications professor talking for 10 minutes about the media, and then an economist talking for 10 minutes about technology obstacles, and then leaving a half an hour for discussion. A session on life without polar bears, which is a sad thought, but one we need to start thinking about. In that one, we're going to have an artist who isn't going to talk about global warming at all, but going to talk for 10 minutes about what makes polar bears such powerful, iconic images. We'll have a philosophy professor talking about the moral implications of mass extinction, and then a biologist who we hope will give us a little bit of room for hope that if we do the right thing, there'll still be some remnant habitat for these beautiful creatures in northern Greenland. So the idea here is if you get dozens of faculty members engaged, and many campuses around the country, this is happening, University of Utah, Cal Poly, just this is sort of a model that's really spread, then you will get thousands of students engaged because each faculty member will bring 100 students either by canceling their classes and attending sessions or giving extra credit or assigning. And what we really need to do as educators is to signal to young people that this really is important.
Is one of the goals of Focus the Nation to influence elected officials?
Absolutely. Yeah, Focus the Nation is about education, but it's also about civic engagement. So we're encouraging every Focus the Nation event to end in the same way, in a roundtable dialogue with political leaders. So across the country, senators, mayors, congresspeople, city councilors, state representatives have all been getting invitations to come sit down with young people and have that roundtable, nonpartisan discussion about their future.
Now, for Powership, the push really came from young people. You're saying this push is coming from somewhat older people, faculty members, who will expose or encourage or maybe require their students to participate. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we're really, the success of Focus the Nation has been primarily the fact that at every college and high school and community college in the country, there are a dozen faculty and staff who recognize the historic moment in which we're living. I mean, our scientists are speaking to us very clearly about the very short window of time that we have for action. Rashendra Poshari, who's the head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, late last year said that if we wait until 2012, that will be too late. He said, what we do in the next few years will determine our future. This is the defining moment. That's coming from the head of the international body of scientists who are evaluating the likely impacts of global warming. And, of course, what Poshari means by that is that if we don't act in the next 2 or 3 years, then a window will close for our children forever. And that window is if we act aggressively and forcefully now, we can hold global warming to 3 or 4 degrees Fahrenheit. But that window is going to close if we don't act in the next couple of years. The stakes are incredibly high for young people, and that is our intent, is to focus the nation around the decisions that we're either going to make or not make in the next couple of years. They're going to have such a critical impact, not only on our own lives and lives of our kids, but in fact for every human being who will ever walk the face of the planet from now until the end of time.
That was Evan Goodstein, founder and director of Focus the Nation and author of Fighting for Love in the Century of Extinction, How Passion and Politics Can Stop Global Warming. Contact the group at area code 503-768-7990 or visit their website at focusthenation.org.
Evan Goldstein was interviewed for the alternative news program Between the Lines. Find them at btlonline.org. You know, we need to hear about this climate crisis over and over again. We are so easily distracted by ourselves, by the culture that demands all of our attention, all of our hours working. Besides, the shift in the planet is so enormous, we can hardly imagine it. As Rajendra Pachauri, a leading spokesman for the IPCC, told one reporter, quote, "You can read as much as you want on these subjects, but it doesn't really enter your system. You don't really appreciate the enormity of what you have." He sees all the scientific evidence, and he can still hardly comprehend what it means. But I don't think the paralysis of fear is any answer. Just this week, I heard a stimulating interview in the program Mind Over Matters. Francis Moore LaPay, the author of Diet for a Small Planet, way back in the 70s, has written two books about conquering personal fear and moving toward self-empowerment, even in a crazy world. Here is a tiny sample of LaPay.
As I often think to myself, no one gets up in the morning, any society, and says, yes, 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 I want to make sure another child dies of hunger today. Or, yeah, I'm going to set my alarm so I can get up and heat the planet and kill species and flood the coastal areas. I mean, no one does that. So why are we creating a world that we as individuals abhor? We've got to figure out the answer to that question. We are showing more and more and more, we people, that what can work is not simply the highest return to existing wealth model of ownership by the distant shareholder, but in fact, producer cooperatives, democratic organization. Today in the world, more people are members of cooperatives than own shares in publicly traded companies. And there are some of the most successful parts of the world in terms of real economic development are those that have a good portion of their economy that has been created by producer and other kinds of cooperatives, such as the northern region of Italy around Bologna. It's one of the wealthiest parts of Europe. And 30-40% of the GDP is created by cooperatives. So I try to suggest that, in fact, it's not all over. We are in a moment of people waking up to the failure of a system that basically disempowers us.
During the interview, we learned that LaPay, for all her fame and expertise, went through years of self-doubt and fear. She described her struggle and ultimate victory over fear in her book, You Have the Power. You Have the Power. I intend to read that. LaPay's new book is called Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. Find out more at www.gettingagrip.net. Abrupt climate change may also bring about social change. Is it time, finally, for eco-justice? For community? Maybe the long emergency will not end up in a global battle zone as predicted by our video game friends. In fact, I predict the far-flung American bases will be closed. The new world economy, one more based in localized production and renewable energy, cannot afford the waste of militarism. It doesn't have to be that way. Abrupt social changes have happened, and it could be happening now. I'm Alex Smith, your host at Radio EcoShock. You can download all our programs and a ton of Good Green Radio free from our website at ecoshock.org. Thanks for joining me this week, and I'd like to dedicate our closing song to all the Wall Street brokers and bankers who made off like bandits. This is the classic Joni Mitchell song, Raised on Robbery.
He was sitting in the lounge of the Empire Hotel. He was drinking for diversion. He was thinking for himself. A little money riding on the maple leaves. Along comes a lady in lacy sleeves. She says,